This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with my usual entry mate here on the show, that is the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld. We are in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and welcoming everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming, either on your smartphone, your tablet, or your computer. It's all there for you at horseracingradio.net. Another fun show planned for you here as we take you through the next hour here on Trainer Talk. And JT, how much you and I launched these shows together a few years back, and Ron Ellis, I remember, was our very first guest. We hosted that show from Santa Anita when we were out there for a race broadcast. And how much fun have these shows been over the years?
Well, it's always entertaining to meet new people and to listen to stories from people that we know. So you never know about trainers' lives and how they got into the game and what drives them to get up at 4 o'clock every morning, 365 days a year, and go to the barn.
You know.
I know, but
you did
not
it for
everybody
20 years.
Else knows. Yeah. Yeah. So it's great to hear the crazy stories and the intimate details of trainers' lives and how guys like Billy Mott couldn't get stalls at Centennial Park in Colorado, and now he's in the Hall of Fame. So.
Yeah, was then looking at, what, 5 grade one winners or 5 champions in his barn at some point in his career? Just amazing.
Yeah, no, so it's cool to have these people on and hear what makes them tick and how they got to where they are.
Well, we're going to hear from another young and up-and-coming training star in our sport here over the course of the next hour. This individual is a native of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and in just his 6th year of training on his own, he has saddled 30 winners, including a pair of Grade 3 victories already. Looking forward to hearing from tonight's guest, that is Francis Trez Abbott III, and he's with us now here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Trez, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me, guys.
Yeah, happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story. Let's start with the Trez part of your name. Where did the Trez part come from?
Because I'm the third, and my dad's Francis as well, and he goes by Franny, and strangely enough, my mother's Francis as well, but with an ES, so they are Franny and Franny, so I couldn't be Franny again, so I was kind of the third one to the equation, so I ended up being Trez.
Yeah, Franny, and Franny. That sounds like a law firm.
Yeah. Yeah. And my grandfather was Frank. So, it was just to make it even more difficult.
That's cool.
Wow. So, all right, so you were kind of already indoctrinated into this sport, so to speak, because of the fact that you had that pedigree behind you. Take me back to the beginning.
I grew up outside of Philadelphia. My dad he got involved with my uncle Rick Abbott, and they kind of did some bloodstock work in the 70s and the 80s, and dad also ran a lot of steeplechase meets and was a steward and is still on the advisory board for the National Steeplechase Stewards and stuff like that, and so he's still involved and he still does some bloodstock work. And then on my mom's side, my grandmother is Betty Moran, Brushwood Stables, so I grew up, you know, I was born, 2 years before Creme Fraiche won a Belmont. So I don't obviously remember it, but I remember the stories from about Woody Stevens, and all the great horses that, you know, Mrs. Moran and Brushwood bred and owned and stuff like that. And, you know, I feel like every time I go up to New York, I get to talk to it. It says, Woody used to say, when you cross over that bridge, the buildings get taller and the competition gets tougher. So it's always kind of rung true for me.
Well, that's a fantastic family history, and obviously the sport's been handed down from one generation to the next. So how do you make your mark now in thoroughbred racing?
I started off in college, and went over to Europe and worked and studied there in London, and I did some bloodstock work for a bloodstock agent, kind of helping him out around the sales, Charlie Gordon Watson over in England while I was in university. So I made a lot of really good contacts over there and did a lot of racing in Newmarket and Ascot and Newbury and a lot of those great, really old racetracks that have a lot of history to them and stuff like that. And, by the time I graduated from university over there, I knew I wanted to be involved in training. I originally went and was going to be a pupil assistant to Andrew Balding, but ended up having my visa turned down because I was overqualified, having recently graduated from college. So the British government didn't see fit that I was actually there to do that job. So I ended up getting an opportunity to go over and work for Aidan O'Brien for 2 years in Ireland, which was an incredible experience. Surrounded by great horses, it was the year that George Washington got brought back from stud. There was Dylan Thomas won an ARC. Horses were brought up, Haradison from Australia. And it was incredible to be around such incredible horses, incredible pedigrees. It was a really blessing for me because I made even more contacts. I got to travel the world. I came back for a Breeders' Cup. I took horses down to Melbourne for a Melbourne Cup. I ran the quarantine unit in Ireland and then spent another three or four weeks down in Australia in Melbourne, which was incredible. I mean, I loved every minute of it. You saw everything, you met new people, you saw the way the Australians did it. And it's been incredible. And after that time, I came back to the UK and I worked for Sir Michael Stout for another year, kind of in the same role as a pupil assistant and, helping out, with everything from, the morning kind of checking legs, feeding, even did the gate work for him and stuff like that. Or even went to the races to load difficult horses into the starting gate at York. It was such a different mentality and different way to train. He trained a lot of well-bred horses for owner breeders. There was an emphasis on patience and developing a career. And I really enjoyed that time with him. He's a great character. He's an incredible trainer. He's a great guy to work for. He's so funny, and just the little things that he sees about horses and the way they're developing, and something, if he's not happy with something, he just says, "We're just going to stop on it. We're going to back off of it, and give it the time to really grow up and develop." Because, the reality is these thoroughbreds they don't stop growing until they're 4, 5, or 6. So, if you're really pushing on a 2-year-old, it's going to really shorten their career. I personally think there's obviously a lot. There are a few exceptions to that rule, but I think for the most part, if they're allowed to develop, they'll last longer. I try to use as much of what I learned from Michael in my training and being at Fairhill and having owners that understand that. Makes it a little bit easier to realize that way of training. And then I came back after the time in England. I came back and I worked for Todd Fletcher down in Palm Meadows for a little while for a winter, which was another great experience. There were so many horses. It was a real eye-opener into, American dirt racing, good horses, Escanderia, Devil May Care, Quality Road, and to see the way a top-class organization is run from the ground down, and the amount of work and everything that Todd puts into it, and the hours that go into making sure everything's just perfect.
Well, it's kind of a shame that you haven't had the opportunity to be around any trainers that have really accomplished anything in our sport, Trez.
Yeah, it's been a little tough. I kind of look back on it and kind of wonder what I was doing.
I was wondering what was the next name you were going to drop, and they just kept getting better and better. That's like one of the most impressive resumes of any trainer we've ever had on this show. I mean, by 31 lengths. It's unbelievable. That's really, really cool.
I appreciate it. No, it was a great experience and education, and you learn, they say you learn you know, from these guys, what, how you want to run your program and how you want to train. You also take things away that you say, right, you know, I, that was too much or that was too little. They need to be a little harder, you know, need to be a little easier on them, or you need to do this. And so, I mean, I've just tried to piece it together. And, you know, I think a lot of my horses, they tend to get better as they get older. So it's been, you know, and I have owners that like to see those horses last. They're owner breeders. They want, you know, they want those, you know, those fillies to go ahead and get black type and stuff like that. And so, I mean, I know, you know, I occasionally run some horses, some fillies in some spots where you kind of think to yourself, you know, where is this? But it's kind of, equated to a lag putt in golf. If you finish in the first three, those fillies for an owner breeder, that black type is worth more to them than, you know, the purse money.
Well, Trez, you throw out names like Aidan O'Brien and Sir Michael Stout and Todd Pletcher, and they are as good as it gets when you talk about training horses in the sport of thoroughbred racing. What are some of the same qualities that each of them have in common that makes them so good and so successful?
The number one thing, and they all train differently, the number one thing is the attention to detail. And the attention to detail of each individual horse. Their memory for, you know, you think, well, there's 100 horses in a barn. You know, those guys that have those number of horses, they have to know where every pimple is, where every hair is out of place. And you see so many of those guys, they just know. Those three, I mean, Todd, you know, he goes through, he checks every horse's leg every morning. They all jog up. You know, if something's changed, he knows it right away. He's the first one in there some mornings, and you think to yourself, you know, wow. Even after, you know, big grade one wins, he's the first one in there. And going through condition books, making sure horses are eating. Sir Michael Stout, he could go off, he could, Newmarket's kind of hundreds of gallops, and he could say, right, you know, this horse did that last week. It really seemed to like it, but maybe it did too much. It didn't eat well the next day. And, you know, and then so then he's constantly thinking, constantly trying to figure out what the best training program is. And Aidan, I mean, you got all these big, strong colts with great pedigrees, and he can watch them all work, and he knows which ones work better in behind, which ones work better upsides, you know, and he just figures it all out, which is incredible. That attention to detail. And I think that's the big thing why guys that get really big are able to continue to perform. I mean, I think you see a lot of trainers, they kind of grow, and it just kind of freewheels a little bit, and it kind of, their success doesn't continue to the same way that it was when they were smaller. And some guys are better off smaller, and some guys, they can handle those big numbers.
One thing that I like to talk about with people often is the difference in training between like a European type style of trainer like Sir Michael Stout as opposed to Todd Pletcher, the emphasis on speed and precocity, whereas Sir Michael Stout emphasis on distance and longevity. Can you talk about that a little bit and the differences and how you've incorporated that into your style?
Sure. I think, you know, you see a lot of American trainers in particular, because there is that emphasis on speed, you know, that quick gait speed. And you see that with Wesley Ward when he sends two-year-olds over to Europe, even the best two-year-old guys in Europe. Those horses, they don't have the gate speed at Ascot. That, you know, the gates open and Wesley's horses are already, you know, four lengths clear of the field, and then they're pretty much getting a head start. You know, where the Europeans, they don't, the percentage, they do care, but, you know, Sir Michael, he could take a horse and he could train as a two-year-old, and it trains, and he does some, you know, longer, slower works, and they pick their works up, and they're, you know, they're steady, and he kind of gets to November as a two-year-old, and he says, well, we've trained it all year long. I'm not just going to put it away for the winter and say, you know, because then that way, what's the horse learned? He learned to train. He hasn't really learned all that much race. He says he's 85% ready. Let's just take him somewhere and just give him a run. And so it just, you know, the horse will run. He'll run mid-pack. He'll be happy. He'll bring him back in the springtime. Same thing. He'll run mid-pack again first time out. And then you watch all the – and then he'll run back in the same race, and all the bettors are all of a sudden, they're all over this horse. They make him favorite because – he's got the benefit of two runs, and that third run, all of a sudden, he just, you know, the light bulb switches on, and this horse just, I mean, just lengthens its stride and just goes away. And then, and he's very patient. He'll work them through the handicap system in Europe, you know, and then all of a sudden at four, they all of a sudden he runs in an Alyssa race, and the horse is very good. And then all of a sudden it's a graded stake horse or a group horse over in Europe. And I mean, it's the patience and it's, you know, the longevity, I guess. I think that a lot of American trainers, they want that speed, you know, it's slap some blinkers on something and you get it out of the gate. And, you know, there's this talk of American horses being bred for speed, but then you watch U.S. bred horses that are brought over to Europe and stuff like that, and they still win at a mile and a quarter, a mile and a half. And I think it has more to do with the training in particular than it does the breeding. And it's that nurturing, you know, they're going to get better as they get older mentality.
Visiting with trainer Trez Abbott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Trez, as you've laid out, you've obviously had the opportunity to be around trainers that have these varying styles and varying philosophies and getting their horses ready to run, kind of the best of all worlds, really. Does that give you an advantage now that you're out on your own?
I think it does, and I think, you know, maybe not gives me a better advantage, but it gives me a greater understanding of what's available and what training techniques are available to me. And then we're based at Fair Hill, so, I mean, we've got the dirt track, we've got the tapeta track, we've also got another 300 acres of hills and gallops, and, I mean, being able to, you know, take a filly that maybe she's a little nervous or she's a little kind of, you know, and then she has a jog day. Well, maybe instead of taking her to the track where horses are galloping at her or galloping by her, you take her out back and you give her a little, you know, you take her out back and you jog around the field for 20 minutes and you give her a little pick of grass and a pat of the neck and you bring her home and, you know, she goes in and she's relaxed and, you know, that gives an opportunity to put on weight and, you know, make it a little bit easier on herself. And, you know, some horses that are, you know, maybe a little sore and stuff like that, and they're just been training on the track sometimes. You know, it's nice to get them out here and gallop them on a hill and do some stuff where they're not thinking they're training and being able to do a little bit less kind of mileage but higher intensity stuff, maybe some hill stuff. You know, we've got a couple of fillies in now that have come from other places, and I know that they've come from guys that are, I mean, they're Hall of Fame guys, they're incredible trainers. And I say to myself, I'm not going to go out there and do anything much different galloping-wise on the track. So I just take him out back on the hills and in the fields and stuff like that and try to freshen them up and then also give them an opportunity to kind of, you know, get a little bit of different scenery. And, you know, also being able to turn them out at Fair Hill kind of gives you a lot more, you know, options in the way you can train them. You can turn them out and let them run around the paddock a little bit, and that's pretty much their warm-up, and you can go straight off the track and they can just gallop and come off before they get themselves all worked up or before they think they know what's going on. You know, and then there's obviously aspects of the American training that, you know, because races are written here a certain way in the configurations of American tracks, you have to also play by the rules here because you need that gate speed. You know, I might not have, you know, first time out winners, but they've got to have enough gate speed that, you know, their second and third starts, they're going to be right there, or, you know, they're able to take the kickback or they're able to train on the dirt, and that speed's been trained into them. So I think, you know, working for all three of those great trainers and then coming back and kind of experimenting a little bit myself with what works well for me, what works well at Fair Hill, I think is probably the best asset that I've had.
Yeah, a lot of guys have a knack for training speed into horses, but not a lot of guys have a knack for being able to train horses to go a long distance. Laz Barrera told me one time that any horse could go a mile and a half. You just had to train them how to do it. And I think that kind of plays into what you're saying. When you got a guy like Baffert whose horses are running right from the bell and can go a mile and a quarter at top speed, you have to have your horses have a modicum of speed to get them in contention in any race. But the distance aspect, I think, is something that's lost on a lot of people. And you see that in training a lot. There's so many trainers nowadays that hardly ever work a horse over a half a mile. I mean, you know, you see him work a horse 5/8 and you figure, wow, this horse must be like a mile and three quarters.
Yeah, well, and all you have to do to kind of get a gauge is to maybe a different way to do things. All you have to do is go back and listen to last week's Trainer Talk show with Olympic gold medalist Bodie Miller, who has a very unique approach and a very unique philosophy when it comes to getting these horses to run at their optimum performance and do it at longer distances. And Trez, you have a great relationship with Bodie. You were the one responsible for putting me in touch with him for that show last week, so thank you for that. But talk about that relationship and that philosophy. It sounds like it kind of falls in lockstep with what you're trying to do.
Yeah, it was funny. It kind of came about. I was at Fairhill one day, and somebody said, oh, you know, Bodie Miller's going to be here. He wants to look at a barn. And, you know, and they said, well, it's kind of similar to yours. You know, could he come over? Obviously, yeah. So we hung out and waited for him a little bit, and I kind of showed him around, and he was so easy to talk to. I mean, probably as you guys, you know, saw last week, he's easy to talk to. He's open about stuff. He's passionate about racing and passionate about his ideas. So as he was trying to develop and put a plan in place to, you know, get his barn up and going at Fairhill, he had a bunch of 2-year-olds that needed to go into training. So, you know, we kind of kept in touch and said, listen, you know, if there's anything I can do to help you out, get these things going. He said, yeah. So we kind of hit it off, and he sent me the 7 2-year-olds and 1 older horse. And we've talked about, you know, we talk about some of the aspects of his training as an Olympic athlete and how to get them to transfer over to the equine athletes. Because, I mean, his biggest thing is he's not trying to make a horse better than it is. He's just trying to get it to reach its full potential. And some horses aren't good, but if they're not reaching their full potential, they're even less good, I guess. So we've talked about a lot of things. You know, he calls me and says, hey, I've got this idea, you know, how – you know, can we do it this way? What do you think? I'd like to try it this way. And, you know, I've got 1 older horse for him, and so we've been kind of playing around with a few things there with the older horse and the 2-year-olds. He's very into the kind of hill training because, you know, that's kind of the closest thing to resistance training for horses is kind of trying to use gravity a little bit. So we do a lot of the hill stuff and then also try to work in that, you know, the speed stuff as well and just trying to get them to reach their full potential. So he's renovating his barn, so we haven't, you know, his whole plan isn't here yet, but he's got his doctor that he worked with a lot when he was training is gonna, you know, kind of go through some stuff and, you know, kind of the science behind it, and we're gonna try to figure out what it's gonna take to try to make our training program better and for the equine athlete, since there's been so many leaps and bounds in kind of human science, sports science. So,
you know, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to look at this, especially the traditionalists, and they're going to say, you know, this Bodie Miller guy, he's crazy. There's no way that this new training regimen is going to work. We've done it the same way for hundreds of years, and it's worked very, very well. Why change anything? And Trez, as you know, this is an industry that doesn't handle change all that well sometimes. What do you say to the naysayers that are going to come to you and to Bodie and say, this approach is never going to work?
You know, I think there are always people that are going to be, naysayers. You know, we've got a lot of support. I've had a lot of people that, you know, I train for, they're racing managers, other people that, you know, I don't know that have come to me and said, you know, this is a great idea. There is a lot of improvement in what we can do. You know, like you said, there are a lot of people, it's been done a certain way for a long time, but there are a lot of aspects to a horse that training is completely against their evolutionary process. I mean, they have evolved to eat high fiber diets constantly over a long, you know, throughout the day, where and to kind of roam, where we kind of lock them up in a stall, feed them high carbohydrates, high starch, and then send them out on a track for 30 minutes, and they get another 30 minutes of walking around the barn, and then all of a sudden they get put back in the stall, and we wonder why they tie up, they have ulcers. So, I mean, you know, there are a lot of things that are, you just kind of glare at you that you can say, you know, that's not, it goes against everything that a horse's body has evolved to be. so I think there are a lot of aspects, and there are also there are a lot of traditional things that work, and they work for a reason. But it also comes down to how can we develop a training program that works and works with horses, because there are certainly a few things that in human sports medicine it doesn't work with horses. You know, there's a mental aspect to it. There's a physical aspect to it. You know, we're talking about 1,100 pound animals on kind of four spindles. So it's a learning process and trying to get it to mirror the equine side of it, to mirror the human side of it. And what works for people isn't necessarily going to be what works for horses, but it's worth a shot. And I think there's a lot of good that can really come of this. And I mean, there are a million different ways to skin a cat, and I've worked in a lot of places all over the world. They train them all differently. The one guy in the next barn trains them differently than the other guy in the next barn does. The Australians do it differently than the English. I mean, it's, you know, there's, everyone can say it's been done a certain way, but it's been done kind of a certain way. Everybody's got their own different ideas of how it's going to work.
Well, a couple hundred years ago, you used to go to the barber and he'd cut your arm and let you bleed all over the place. And they thought that made you healthy, you know. So yeah. I mean, and that was only 200 years ago. So there's certainly a lot of things that have happened in the meantime that have been good for the human race. And I got to feel like it's the same for horses, you know. I mean, naysayers in the thoroughbred business are, you know, countless. And so I don't think anybody should be deterred when people say, oh, you can't do this or that. But one thing, if you train horses long enough, you learn, as you say, there's many ways to skin a cat. I had a gal work for me one time that was kind of into Santeria, and I had a horse with a bad foot, and she said, I can fix this horse. You know, we had messed around with him for about a month and a half, and I said, all right, I'm at my wit's end. You go ahead and do what you want to do. So she did her voodoo, made some kind of mystery paste, put it on the horse's foot, and in 2 days he was sound. So I learned that day that, you know, all the conventional stuff sometimes doesn't necessarily have the answer, but you can do something that seems crazy at the time and it works like a charm. So not everybody has all the answers, and it's going to be interesting to see what you guys do with this. I'm really excited about it. I really enjoyed hearing Bodie's thoughts on things, and I'm glad you're involved in it because you have the resume to tell him you really are crazy.
Trez, stay with us. We're going to get to a quick commercial break. We're going to come back and continue this visit in the second half of the program. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Fasig Tipton November sale annually posts the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. Over the past 10 years, 142 fillies and mares have brought prices over $1 million, and 3 world records have been broken. Last year, the Fasig Tipton November sale sold 23 seven-figure fillies and mares, more than any other mixed sale in the world, with an average sale price far greater than our nearest competitor. The world's premier breeding stock event, November 1st, 2015 at Fasig Tipton. Where will you be?
And they're off to New York, the premier statebred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Start now with your Cal Density Mare and Foal Feeding Program. Sales results were obvious at this year's Keeneland September Yearling Sale. Yearlings produced from mares fed Cal Density through their formative year were impressive, as well as horses trained and raced in 2014 and so far in 2015. Clean radiographs, conformity, strong bones, and overall health was the big winner at auction and on the track. Order your plan today at caldensity.com or call 877-744-9006 for more information.
The Breeders' Cup runs here.
What a memorable Breeders' Cup Classic. It's a race for the ages. Bayern, Toast of New York, California Chrome. Bayern, Toast of New York. Bayern has won it.
The Breeders' Cup, October 30th and 31st. Exclusively here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
presented by Cal Density. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information and to listen live. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
So they quicken up less than 3 furlongs to go in the Oaks. And on the inside, Three Hearts is trying to hang on to the lead. But Nellie Cashman is there on the outside as Long Shot. They make the turn in for home. And Nellie Cashman has a head in front from Three Hearts. It's 3 lengths that He Done Me Wrong song in third. Preya's trying to quicken up there from fourth. Three Hearts, Nellie Cashman on the outside, trying for that upset. Nellie Cashman, Forest Boyce, Three Hearts, Joel Rosario, Nellie Cashman, gonna cash in at a big price to win the Oaks. Late run for Player to make it close to Three Hearts there, and it'll be wrong song.
Our man Dave Rodman with the call of the Grade 3 Virginia Oaks in 2013, and Nellie Cashman cashing in for trainer Trez Abbott. That was his very first stakes winner, and he does it in a Grade 3, and he does it with a horse that was owned by his father's syndicate, Sycamore Racing. We'll talk to him about that in the second half of the program. Do want to welcome everybody back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington studios. And JT, how good is Dave Rodman? That was cool.
Yeah, Dave comes up with some stuff. He's a very nice man, and I always enjoy spending time with him when we're in Maryland. He really loves the game and spends a lot of time studying horses and pedigrees and things, and that was a great call.
Trez, I know you hated to hear that again, didn't you? Sorry to put you through it.
That's like the greatest thing ever, you know, and that you know, Nellie Cashman's going to cash in at a big price. That's like burned into my brain.
Yeah, ran so huge that day, sent off at odds of nearly 20 to 1, thus the upset. And she was a daughter of Mineshaft. I mentioned that you trained her for your dad's syndicate, Sycamore Racing. Tell me about Nellie Cashman and the ownership group.
When I first started, my dad kind of came to me and says he'd been doing bloodstock work for a while. He says, how do you feel about putting together a syndicate, buying two fillies for under $100,000 and putting the syndicate together? And the fillies have residual value. We'll sell them at the end of it. We'll divide it up, 10 shares. It'll include all the training stuff, or all the training costs and everything. I said, it sounded great to me. So we went off that first year to Keeneland, September, and we purchased an Any Given Saturday filly at, I think, Fasig Tipton in July, and we were stomping around the sales ground at Keeneland, and he said, I want you to look at this filly. So we went and looked at it. She was RNA'd. We went back and looked at her again, and I remember we were driving home, and he's like, I bought that filly. So she always showed something a little special. Even when she was being broken, she kind of came in with a reputation. She's always a really big filly, so she came in with a little bit of a reputation of being quite nice. So we kind of trained her along, and she ran a couple times at two. She was second first time out, which she made a big run going 6 furlongs on the dirt, and so we kind of played around with her a little bit, tried to get her to break her maiden, took her down to Florida and gave her a little bit of a break, and she came back and ran a great second, first time on the turf. I think Rosie rode her at Pimlico in that kind of jockey challenge on Black Eyed Susan Day. And she kind of like, you know, two turns, turf, switched her on. And so then I took her up to Penn National and ran in a PA bred maiden, which she won really well. And we'd always kind of liked her. I ran her in the Blue Mountain Stakes for Pennsylvania Breds in November as a 2-year-old. And she got interfered with going down the back, a horse fell, and so I said, you know what, let's take a shot in the Virginia Oaks. And I kind of the stakes coordinator at Colonial, Shane Burke, who works at Laura on the racing office, he says, I'll call you if it's going to be short. And there are a couple of jock agents that always joke with me that, you know, that's kind of, you're talking dirty to me if you tell me a stake's coming up a little short. It always kind of freaks my ears. So he said to me, all right, yeah, no, we got 7. And I was like, all right. He's like, you'll make 7. So I said, yeah, all right, throw her in there. If it's 8 or 9, take me out. And he was like, yeah, okay. So the entries came out and there were like 11 in there and I was still in it. So,
so typical.
Yeah.
Shocker.
Yeah.
Even when you think a guy's your friend, if he's the stakes coordinator, he's not your friend.
No, I equate it to being like a high school girl before the prom. You know, everybody tells you look beautiful and it's the right spot, you know, and you're the only one. But so we ran it. We took a shot and, I mean, Forrest gave her a perfect ride. Forrest had ridden her a bunch, and I mean, she put her in a great spot. They went a little slow early on, and Nelly just kind of kicked and kept going. Which, you know, I lost my voice for 3 days after that, and none of the syndicate members were there because they all thought, I think they all thought I was crazy. but I mean, it was a huge win, and I mean to do it for my dad, who, you know, and the first syndicate was made up of, you know, a lot of people that knew me growing up and were family friends, and you know, it's been great. You know, we all get together for the Breeders' Cup and watch the Breeders' Cup, and they try to get the racing as much as they can when she runs. So you know, she went up to we took her up to Saratoga for the Boston or the Lake Placid, and I mean, she put in another huge run. Got a little tight there just under the wire, and she ended up getting taken down, which was a tough swallow, but you know, it's kind of cutting your teeth, and you know, you kind of pay your dues if you have to come around for her. But you know, it was justification that she was a good filly, and we weren't insane for running her in the Virginia Oaks, and it wasn't a fluke. You know, so I mean, she shows up, she runs hard every time I put her in some tough old spots. She ran third in the Boston Spa last year. You know, and we ran in the De La Rose this year. My God, I mean, you know, Jimmy Toner won it with Recepta, and Jimmy sends me some horses from New York that don't fit. And we were talking, you know, we talked about, hey, Jimmy, oh, I love that. You know, I love the filly. And so his filly, you know, she came back and she won the Noble Damsel there the other week. I mean, she got beat by some good fillies and they went quick and they weren't backing up. So I looked at it and I said to myself, you know, what are we going to do with her the rest of the year? What are our options? I said, you know, we got the two races in New York, the Noble Damsel and the Athenia. I said, you're just going to meet the same fillies you just ran against. And she ran fifth, and she's 5 years old, and she's wisened up to it all. You know, she's fought a couple of hard fights, and she just kind of, you know. So I said, you know, let's try on the poly track up at Prescott. She had the speed. She worked great out of the gate one day. So I said, you know, we'll give her a shot on the poly. She trained over great here. So, you know, the reasoning behind running her in the Prescott Masters was, you know, I thought maybe the change of surface, the change of distance along with the addition of blinkers would kind of help her, might kind of spark her a little bit. But, you know, it didn't do the job, but, you know, nothing lost, nothing gained, you know. So she's going to go to the Keeneland November sales this year. To disperse that syndicate group. So, I mean, she's been great to me, and it's unfortunate, you know, she won't stick around and stuff like that, and you know, but I'm sure she'll go to a great home, and she's multiple graded stakes winner, multiple graded place, and so, you know, she's been good to me, and so, you know, it's incredible. When that decision was made, you kind of look down the shed row and you think to yourself, I've seen a lot of horses come and go in her career in and out of the barn that A, weren't good, or B, weren't as sound as she is. And she's plugged on as a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, and 5-year-old. And she shows up, runs hard, and she's going to be a hard one to replace if she ever is. Because I know there are guys that spend their whole careers looking for stakes winners, nonetheless graded stakes winners, and to have, you know, one, if not, you know, the two that we've had. In the first couple of years of training, I mean, it's a big deal.
Well, not only did that grade 3 Virginia Oaks come up with a much bigger field than you expected, Trez, but counted among that group that you had to defeat were horses trained by Hall of Famers Jonathan Shepherd and Roger Atfield, plus you throw in Graham Motion and Mike Maker. When you do break through in a spot that's as salty as that race was, is there a part of you that says, hey, you know what? I can do this. What I'm doing is working. I can do this as a trainer.
Yeah, it definitely does. And, you know, being based at Fair Hill, I mean, you know, Graham's up here, Michael Matz is here, Mike Trombetta. It's such a friendly atmosphere. And I remember when, you know, there's part of you that says, you know, this is awesome. I can't believe it's happened, but, you know, and I can do this. But there's also part of you that's got to say, you know, and like any trainer, you're only as good as the ammunition you have in your barn. So, you know, you kind of got you got to give, you know, plenty of credit to the horses and stuff like that. But it's nice to kind of break through and stuff like that. And even you know, after the Boston Spa, as I was running down the grandstand at Saratoga or the Lake Placid, I was running down the grandstand. You know, Mike Trombetta high-fived me, Graham high-fived me. You know, there were guys that were happy to see me do well. And you know, that's kind of what it's all about. You know, you work hard. It is a fraternity because everybody gets up early. Everybody works hard. We're not doing this for the great hours or the great pay, or the benefits and the vacation time, because that is few and far between.
Yeah, it's great when the other trainers recognize you. I remember when I won my first graded race, first 100 grander at Santa Anita, and somebody said to Charlie Whittingham, who finished behind me that day, wasn't it great that Jude won that graded race? And he goes, well, I don't know. He says, you got to squash the ants before they eat the whole picnic. And that was so Charlie. But I remember Chuck Marikian, who was my barn mate. He had about 20 horses in the barn I was stable at. He literally picked me up off the ground. Now, in those days, I probably weighed slightly less, but it guaranteed I was 275. And he literally picked me up off the ground after I won that race, and I didn't think anybody could do that. It was such a great feeling, and I know what that's like. That's just an incredible feeling when people that you work with every day are so happy for you, especially in such a competitive business.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about it, and you know, I'm so lucky to be at Fairhill, and you know, and the whole training fraternity. I mean, it's, you know, everybody's happy to see, for the most part, happy to see each other do well, especially when they're smaller outfits and stuff like that. And you know, the big guys are usually happy to see you do well and stuff. So, I mean, you know, that's what's wonderful about what we do. You know, there's a great camaraderie about it.
Talking with Trez Abbott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of this show or any of our talk shows, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and of course, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, to check out the podcast of all of our programs each and every week and listen at your leisure. Well, Nellie Cashman, Trez, was your first Greatest Stakes winner. In 2014, the following year, you come back and win the Grade 3 Eatontown with Medea for Cornerstone Thoroughbreds. Tell me about Medea and that experience.
That was another, she was a filly that my brothers and I actually bred. When I was over in Europe, I acquired the mare privately, and she was carrying Medea, so we foaled Medea there and left her. And she came back, we brought her back over here when I started training, and she, you know, before she was meant to come over, she got cast as a three-year-old halfway through the year in July. So she came over to us. She'd been cast. She'd banged her knee. I said to my brothers, I said, listen, guys, I said, you know, from what we've seen this filly run in Europe, I know she's good. Let's give her the time, not rush her. So we took her down to Florida and kind of debuted her as a four-year-old at Gulfstream. And she broke slow, circled the field, and finished second to a filly of Bill Moss that was pretty good. She'd come out of a really good maiden up in Belmont. I forget her name. And so, you know, we were delighted. Went to run her back at Gulfstream again. She was like 4-5. I've never been so confident walking over the paddock in my life. Put the tack on her, threw the jock up, walked her out the tunnel, turned around to go take, you know, find a place to watch it from. And, you know, Larry Comas comes over the loudspeaker. You know, Medea's been scratched. I turn around, she's, you know, 22 in it down the straight the wrong way back to the receiving barn. So she was a work in progress. I mean, she banged herself up getting loose, so gave her another 6 months and brought her back. She broke her maiden, and she was always a very talented filly. She just always was very quirky. She was never nominated to the Eatontown. I had entered her for two other than at Belmont, and it didn't go. And so I called the stakes coordinator, and he said, we got a short field. I said, well, sign me up.
And how many were in that race?
When I signed up, when I called him, I think he had like five, and I think there ended up being like seven or eight.
All right.
So we supplemented her to it, and, you know, the rest is kind of history. I mean, she was, we got her up there. She was doing great. And I mean, Fars gave, put her, you know, sat right off the leaders and gave her another great ride. And she did the business, which is very exciting, you know, to be able to not only, you know, train my second graded stakes winner, but also to have owned her and bred her with my brothers. I've got three younger brothers that is about their extent in the horse racing industry. They all work outside of it. But it's a good way to stay in touch with each other. And we've got Medea's half sister here at Fairhill, who's a 3-year-old who broke her maiden this year. And, you know, it's exciting, you know, and I love it. I mean, what's better than, you know, being close to people and, you know, training for people that you enjoy training for. And I've been lucky enough. We've got a great group of owners here now at Fairhill. We've got like 25 horses at Fairhill. You know, we've got a real good mix of owner breeders, you know, some new guys, new young people to the game. Justin Nicholson's 90 North, that Jimmy Toner trains the majority of the horses. I kind of get the ones that don't fit in New York. So, I mean, you know, it turned out to be a real good partnership. You know, if Jimmy says, listen, they're not cutting it up here, you know, we just bring them down here and try to find a good spot for them and get them to win some races. We've got some other really good young guys and, you know, people that enjoy the game and, you know, are patient, understand that horses, they're not machines. Stuff's going to go wrong. You know, they're just happy they come out and they love their horses. So, I mean, it's a pleasure to do what I do, with such great owners and people that send you good horses and really enjoy it.
Well, that's certainly one way to endear yourself to new clients is to have that line of communication open and have them be welcome at the barn. And so many outfits, especially the bigger ones, they don't have time really to cater to everybody. I mean, they do the best they can, but there's nothing that beats that one-on-one interaction with the trainer that gets what you're trying to do. And I tell people all the time they should pick their trainers more like they would pick a date, you know? I mean, a lot of times they go to the standings and they look and see who's won the most races that week, and that's who they give their horses to. But, you know, it's a relationship that should last a long time and should be, you know, carefully cultivated. And it sounds like you got the right combination there.
Yeah, I hope so. It's been fun. They're some good guys.
Trez, you mentioned earlier going to the sales and picking out Nellie Cashman with your dad. When you do go to the sales, you head out to Fasig Tipton, and you're going to look for a young horse. What are some of the keys for you when you're picking out yearlings?
For us, we kind of have a little bit of a set criteria because we have a little bit of a limited budget, and so we cap it at 100 grand and say, right, this, what is it going to take? We're either going to try. It's usually, I probably shouldn't give away my secrets. My dad will probably get on me about this, but it's usually a younger mare. Because if it's a filly, if it's a mare that's already produced a stakes winner, we're not going to afford it. It does, you know, for the most part. And if you can't afford it and it's already a half sibling to a stakes winner, you probably don't want it. So we kind of, you know, when we go through the catalog, do the catalog stuff, you know, younger mares, stallions that are going to get you runners. They might not get you superstars, but they're going to get runners, you know, because that's what people want. They want action. They want to go to the races. They want to win races, and for the most part, a lot of them just want to win races. You know, they don't have to be stakes races. If they're winning races, they're paying their way. People are having a good time. That's what they want. So we try to get, you know, a stallion that's going to get you a runner, and they're always fillies. And we go out every year and buy two fillies. We bought a filly this year. We bought two fillies actually in Keeneland. Dad kind of goes out early, kind of does all the legwork, and then I kind of show up, and we kind of do the rest of it together. We bought a big, strong, beautiful First Samurai filly that's she's out of a half sister to Commissioner and Laugh Track. So I mean, she's got the pedigree. She's a big, strong filly, you know. So I mean, there's already residual value there. We bought a Malibu Moon filly out of a stakes place, Rahi Mare. You know, a little bit on the smaller side, but that's what Rahi gets. You know, they're both first or second foals. So you know, there's For what we're looking for and what we're trying to do for the syndicate, you know, you're looking for a nice athletic individual, and then the pedigree that kind of makes sense to you. And we also kind of, you know, when you when you get one vetted, we get one vetted, and the vet comes back as well. It's got this, not going to affect the end user for racing, but going to put the two-year-old guys off. We go, that's awesome. You know, if there's a little blemish there that, you know, a little bit extra time, you know, but the two-year-old guys, time's of the essence for them, you know, so it's going to keep them off this. That's kind of the gravy train for us when, you know, there are little things that, you know, we can take the time and, you know, give them the time. And that fits into my program too, you know, so it all kind of, it's what works for us. And, you know, it's been good to us. I mean, we had Camille Claudel in the second year. She broke her maiden by 19 lengths at Laurel, you know, ran a good second allowance down in Gulfstream. Behind one of Todd's fillies that came back, we ran fourth in the Gulfstream Park Oaks, and that filly won it. I mean, you know, so it's an equation that's worked well. And so we're kind of sticking to it. So every year we've bought two more, so it's fun.
Will you ever go to the two-year-old in training sales to buy horses?
Yeah, I mean, we've done that, and I've had clients that, you know, that say, let's go do that. And, you know, I think you're paying a little bit more of a premium because, you know, guys have already, they've done the work. And, you know, they've got a little bit of an idea of what's going to hold. You know, you're paying for kind of, you have a little bit of a better idea of what's going to hold up. And so, you know, I would prefer with the budgets that a lot of my clients shop with, I'd prefer to go buy yearlings because, you know, I think you can get a little more bang for your buck without, you know, having, you know, with some of these guys, you know, if you got a couple hundred grand and you want to go buy a nice two-year-old, at the two-year-old training sales, I think that works. And I know a lot of horses come out of the sales with, you know, they're inexpensive or they don't breeze well, but they move well, or, you know, it's a numbers game, though. I think kind of for a lot of that kind of stuff, I think there are probably a lot of horses that go through there that are cheap that don't make it. So, I mean, you know, a horse is a horse at the end, but, you know, and with the two-year-old sales, it's something I haven't had a lot of luck with. So, I prefer the yearling sales.
Yeah, I think the bulk of trainers probably would. You get to, like I like to say, mess them up yourself. You don't need help. Get when you go buy one out of a 2-year-old sale, a lot of times, you know, they've been trained pretty hard to get those flashy works, and it always kind of drove me crazy that you know, you won't buy a horse unless he goes 10 flat, but if your exercise rider went out there and breezed a baby 10 flat, you'd strangle him when they came back. So I don't really understand the whole basis of 2-year-old and training sales myself, but I think most trainers would rather get one from scratch and control its entire career as opposed to getting one that's already been honed on pretty good.
Yeah, and I think the guys I've found that the guys that do the bloodstock agents that do really well buying two-year-olds, they're not showing up at the sales watching them train. They're going to the farms, they're going and talking to the two-year-old consigners and stuff like that. They're boots on the ground, where I don't have the time to go up to Ocala and spend a week looking at 2-year-old breeze and train. And, you know, so, you know, for me, yearlings show up, look at them, go through the pedigrees, go, you know, I think that makes it easier. You know, but there are certainly guys that have a lot of success buying 2-year-olds out of the sales, but I mean, they do a lot of work, and it's not just at the sales grounds.
Trez Abbott on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Trez, when you do have the opportunity to get away from the racetrack and kind of do some other things, what other hobbies or interests do you have?
Well, I used to love skiing, but now my new relationship, now I don't ski anymore since I've started training. So my new relationship with Bodie, I think, is kind of strictly a professional one. But I do, when we go down to Florida and, you know, we kind of cut back on horse a little bit, and do love to go fishing and stuff like that. We had a great time this winter. We're down there. Reed Baker was down there, and there were a couple other trainers and the clocker from Palm Beach Downs. We'd go fishing and stuff like that, and we had a great time. I mean, I caught a huge Spanish mackerel that the captain was like, I've never seen one that big. So I need to say I've got that on my wall. Yeah, I mean, we being able to do that and, you know, just kind of putzing around the house, you know, doing, fixing some stuff up, renovating some stuff, and, you know, just being able to kind of take a deep breath and, you know, try not to get too far away from the barn, because that there always seems like there's something that can go wrong.
Would you end your retirement from skiing if Bodie Miller came to you and said, hey, let's go hit the slopes?
I don't think so. I think I was a pretty good athlete in high school. I think I've come to realize that, you know, I'm on the backside of that slope.
You can take Bodie fishing.
Yeah, exactly. I'll take Bodie fishing.
When you guys...
he's got a new baby. I don't know how much time he's got really on his hands either.
Yeah, he mentioned that the other day when we were talking to him. I don't know how much sleep he's getting either. I can't wait till he runs one down the hill at Santa Anita. You think the fans will load up on that one? A Bodie Miller horse coming down the hill?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Trez Abbott here on Trainer Talk. Trez, one last question. What is your most prized piece of racing memorabilia in your house?
I have got, hanging above my desk in a wall box, when I was working for Aiden O'Brien, we had champion stayer Yates that won the Ascot Gold Cup 4 years in a row. And I was like a foreman in that barn. And I got his two front shoes before he won his fourth Gold Cup. They weren't the ones he actually wore, but I got that put in kind of a little window box. I gave one to my dad, and the other one is hanging above my desk, and it's still got the wood chip track from Ballydoyle in the grooves of the Queen's Place.
Oh, that's fantastic. What a great thing to
cool.
own, especially since you were so close to the horse.
Yeah, it's so cool.
He was a cool horse. He was a big, big black. I mean, he was a runner too, but I mean, he was, you know, 2 miles, 2.5 miles. He would just grind horses into submission. He was a cool horse to be around, but he was a big colt. When he was ready to run, he was a handful.
Other than your own horses, all the great trainers you worked for, was there a particular horse that you were close to, or that you really appreciated?
I was very fond of Devil May Care when she was with Todd. Quality Road had such a great presence about him and stuff like that. I mean, he was such a cool horse. And I remember, I mean, that was kind of the first thing I was like, you know, Todd's Todd, and he's super focused and stuff like that. I remember when Quality Road won the Donnie, broke his own track record. You know, I came in, you know, whatever time I came in, it was like 4:15 in the morning or whatever to get in there and start taking temperatures. And Todd was sat there going through his condition book, just looking for who's running next and where they're going to run and what race he's going to win next. And I was like, this guy's a machine. Quality Road was cool. He was a big cool horse, but I love Devil May Care. She was beautiful. There's so many of them. I mean, that's the tough thing about it. I've been lucky. I've been really, really, really lucky, not only to do what I love, but to be around some incredible horses working for other people, but then also, you know, to have had the horses go through my barn, you know, in the first 5 or 6 years. I mean, I do realize that, you know, I'm incredibly lucky and happy to be at Fairhill. And, you know, it's a blessing because, you know, like they say, you do what you love, you never work a day in your life.
Yeah, well said. Trez Abbott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Trez, really do appreciate the time. So glad we had the chance to catch up. We'll remind our listeners to go to our website, check out a podcast at horseracingradio.net. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those out to you. And continued success, my friend. Keep it rolling.
Great. Thanks very much, guys.
Good stuff, huh?
Yeah, fantastic.
All right, for our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jute Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We're going to talk to you next time right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.